Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, and I too will speak in a personal capacity. Can I begin by suggesting three assertions which I don't think will be controversial? The first is that the United Kingdom would manage perfectly well outside the European Union. Secondly, that the EU as an organisation is far from perfect. Although I don't go as far as Lord Ridley in the list of dafter decisions which he set out, to actually blame the EU for the failure of a British government against immigration figures of, who knows, 200,000 a year-ish, more perhaps, to add on 1,000 extra to take those talented people you're talking about. If the British government can't take that decision, then the British government can't take a rational decision. But against the scale of the overall figure, it's a drop in the ocean, and it's a particularly useful drop, and I'm with you 100%, but the answer is in Westminster. And my third assertion is that the United Kingdom is one of the world's leading scientific nations and has always worked with international collaborators. If you look around the figures that smile down upon us in this institution, the Foreign Secretary was always one of the most influential posts within the Royal Society. And as the House of Lords report has shown, since 1973, European cooperation, as you'd expect, following membership, much enhanced. I think it's been good for universities, for research, for the student experience. It's fostered greater openness to staff, to students, to ideas, and to research collaboration with European institutions, universities. And the results are set out in the report. I'm not going to repeat them other than to stress, but 18.3% of EU funding in the United Kingdom is spent on research and development, which represents 3% of total R&D spend in the United Kingdom. Free movement has led to the employment of more researchers from other member states. That's perfectly true and probably desirable. And much increased collaboration has led to the success that was set out by Jocelyn within successive framework programs. If it's less, as the report demonstrates, on structural funds expenditure, let me point out that that is not the case for the Celtic nations. And the Celtic nations on the whole have done well on both sides of this. And for student movements, Erasmus has proved successful, would have been more successful in the United Kingdom had we had more students with linguistic capabilities to go study in other universities in the other member states. But of course, given the United Kingdom's net contribution to the EU budget, it can be argued very rationally that we're only getting back some of our own money. Outside the EU, we could keep all our own money. We could spend it as we wished. We could spend it to match or even increase what's spent on R&D. I heard a minister at the weekend arguing that farmers need not worry at all about being outside the CAP because there's all this own money that we can hypothecate to agricultural support. Our own money is being hypothecated pretty extensively. It's going to have to go a long way to cover all these people who are otherwise getting receipts elsewhere. And the question for researchers is pretty simple. Do you believe you would get back even the same level of funding to replace that which you currently get from the EU if it were all left to Westminster to decide? Or indeed, is there any certainty about the level? Would it be ring-fenced? What would be the risk of reductions? How sustainable would that income be? And that would be a particularly acute problem for peripheral regions in the United Kingdom and for three nations, and indeed for smaller universities. And additionally, of course, the financial incentive to collaborate with European universities, etc., would be reduced. But it can be argued, it's been argued tonight, that we could continue as non-members to participate in EU research programmes. Yes, a lot do already. But we would lose influence on the formulation of those programmes. I've actually sat in the Research Committee of the European Union, conscious how much effort successfully went in to make sure that the sort of policies that we wanted the EU to pursue were the policies that suited us, would get more revenue, and particularly met the priorities of the British government and of UK researchers. And we were pretty successful. So the great thing about that is where you've succeeded, throw it out. Instead, well, we can form some arrangement from outside, and we can expect the same degree of influence as we currently enjoy. It's a bit like resigning from a club on Friday, pitching up on Monday, and expecting to take advantage of exactly the same facilities as you'd enjoyed in the previous week. Now, EU Future Horizon 2020 scales up university cooperation to tackle the most critical global problems. Jocelyn listed a number of them, all better dealt with multilaterally, and the second aim, to create more competitive, productive, and innovative economies. Difficult to argue with those as priorities for the EU and which would benefit the United Kingdom. Now, it's said that the EU stifles innovation. I think it was 1981 when the EU produced its first communication on innovation. The then Department of Industry, I sat in meetings there at the time, actually condemned the concept. They poured scorn upon it. And I'll just note that that department has morphed into the Department of Business, Innovation, and innovation was not something that the British government was advocating at all, but Europe was. Now let me move on to a more general argument. What are the advantages of being within this European Union? Well, firstly, global challenges, they require multilateral cooperation. Any of those issues, terrorism, environment, climate change, energy, food security, you can't sort them out as well on your own. British government, of course, opposed the inclusion of environment within the EU treaties. They were actually introduced in 1987, and after that, lots of regulations, directives applied to the United Kingdom. I remember my horror in Canada in 1975 that the province of Quebec put all its sewage into the Ottawa River. How could anyone do that in 1975? And then in 1980, I went back to the little port in West Wales and realized that the sea that I had swum in as a child, all the sewage went straight out 100 metres behind the pier, untreated. That's how we actually lived at the time. Now, good sense and EU influence led to an improvement, but also the simple realisation that pollution, environmental factors, do not respect national boundaries. If you're going to tackle those, you're better tackling them together. Secondly, I think the EU enhances our security. I'm not going to get in an argument about NATO or the EU. NATO is collective defence, absolutely. But if you define security as being terrorism, food security, climate change, all those other aspects, then actually the EU has a very strong role to play in making us more secure. The economic advantages, thirdly, are there, and I think they've been demonstrated over the years, although we don't have a control. And lastly, influence in this world. Now, there's an assumption that good old United Kingdom, on its own, because we belong to so many organizations, we can exert so much influence, and it goes along with a sort of argument, really, I'm a passionate European, it's just I'm against the European Union. I'm an internationalist, but I don't want to actually cooperate with these particular organizations. Even though we're in them, leading them to a considerable extent, and could lead much more, but there's an argument that goes, well, we're better outside. If you replaced the provisions of the treaties of the European Union by bilateral agreements to produce the same effect between 28 countries, that would require 378 bilateral agreements. The challenge of negotiating those and trying to get a degree of consistency among each of them, I think, is impossible. But outside, of course, we could recover our sovereignty. We would be independent, regain where we should be. So what is sovereignty worth in today's world? It's actually, I think, curbed by individual choice and by external events. We should be able to defend ourselves without interference from Brussels. Yes, but not from NATO, of course. When we signed up, and indeed, as Peter argued, when we actually molded the NATO treaty in 1949, Article 5 says very simply, an attack on one is an attack on all, and you're obliged to respond. Greater effect on sovereignty? Difficult to imagine. European Convention on Human Rights, scores of conventions that the UK has willingly signed up to. Why? Because they were of benefit to us and we thought would create probably a better world. But they constrain what we can do. The Security Council of the United Nations, if a certain form of resolution is passed, regardless of the laws in 193 countries, that overrules any law. And it's binding on 193 countries. So sovereignty isn't absolute, is it? And then there's the involuntary. The impact of a 2008 financial crisis, of a 1992 run on the pound to get you out of the exchange rate mechanism. And how many of us, if we'd been debating 18 months ago with the price of oil touching $120 a barrel, would have imagined that 3 months ago it would have reached something like $35 a barrel? In fact, it's 47 today, and 33% up is still a massive decrease on our expectations 2 years ago. So our freedom, as they're discovering in Scotland, is not quite as great as you thought it might have been. And the need to work with other countries on a range of areas for the betterment of our country and to use the collective weight and influence. That's why we belong to the European Union. And I won't labour the point about the single market, but if the single market was meant actually to bring, as it did, substantial economic gain, then I think logically it will follow. But if we are not fully members of the single market, then we're going to lose economically. Very much hope in questions that somebody asks for the difference between all the spurious arguments about a free trade area and what is a single market and the conditions attached to it and why. Norway, Switzerland, much mentioned. All their agreements with the EU presume and require free movement of people. They require budget contributions. When Norway chose, but actually didn't want to sign and join the European Union, but opted for the European Economic Area, it ended up, what, the eighth, ninth most biggest contributor to the EU budget. The Spaniards really, if you'll forgive me, screwed the Norwegians over access to fish. It was a very, very robust negotiation. And they've ended up having to accept all the laws passed in the European Union, just like that. And on the two-day debate in the Storting, I think something in excess of 1,000 bits of legislation was summarily voted through, because that was the price of actually joining the European Economic Area. So the idea that outside there is some better place where it's freer with no conditions and that we can enjoy our newfound freedom, I think that to a considerable extent it's an illusion. This question of the imposition of laws by bureaucrats in Brussels, by the European Parliament, really somebody ought to just understand that most of the big decisions involve the agreement which was given by successive British governments. And the British governments were stuck in there in the middle of those negotiations. I'll end where I started. I'm not for a moment going to claim that the European Union is some sort of panacea. Manifestly, it isn't. But in what I regard as an increasingly insecure world, global problems abound. Interstate conflict is becoming more likely, and that we would be better placed working with our allies and friends in the European Union. Churchill's comment was, there's only one thing worse than actually negotiating with your allies, and that is having no allies with whom to negotiate. And that remains actually true. For me, I reject the concept of brave old Blighty, off alone to find some new relationship in an uncertain world. I don't believe those relationships will be any better. In fact, I'm very dubious about many of them existing. I'd much rather we appreciate what we have and then made a real effort to do what we should be doing, which is to take a leading role in that European Union and make it a better place, but actually together then tackle the problems we confront. Thank you very much.